Hi, I'm Mike McCafferty, and I want to give you a sports analogy to start out with. Don't worry, it'll be a short one and it'll have a point. Imagine that you're playing a basketball game. And I chose basketball because I was going to choose American football, but I thought maybe people outside the country would have a problem with it, and people inside the country, if I use soccer, you get the picture. Imagine you're playing a basketball game and your team is doing poorly. You thought you were going to be amazing, but you tanked the first half. You absolutely blew it. So the second half, most of your team goes home. Everyone goes home. Everyone assumes that the game is over. And so they just throw out a bunch of scrubs, including yourself. And you go out there and they just say, hey, just do the best you can. You know, try not to lose by 1,000. And everyone goes home. All the team goes home. And then you play the second half. But because you're gritty and scrappy and you have nothing to lose, something strange happens. You play so hard and you play so tight and so focused that you start to come back. Slowly but surely, you start to come back. Until at the very, very end, it is such a close game that there's like 0.2 seconds left on the scoreboard and the score is really close, but they score on you and you're like, oh no, and with so little time left, you're 94 feet away from the basket, so you just fling the ball up in the air and you just sort of walk away saying, that's it, there's no chance it's going to go in. And then the crowd goes wild. And you turn to see that the ball has actually gone in the basket. And you are elated. You're overjoyed. Everyone is on their feet screaming because you somehow pulled this rabbit out of a hat. That's a different metaphor. I'm sorry about that. You did that. And everyone's on their feet. And this scrappy little team finally did it. And you guys are... Well, you're not the champions. Because the way that you played the game, you didn't win the game. You tied. And so now you have to go to overtime. So suddenly, everything that you sacrificed, all of those sacrifices that you made to get you to that one moment, now you have to figure out how to keep playing the game. And you are sort of going, as Mr. Spock might say,
to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Or woman, or person, or alien, or robot. Because you've just finished Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and your audience loves what you did. You pulled a rabbit out of your hat using 1/7 of the original budget for the motion picture. You somehow created this masterpiece, this gritty, scrappy little show, this little movie that was almost a TV movie on ABC. Somehow you pulled all that out, and your victory has stunned people, and the emotional depths has made people cry for more. And so, yes, you will get to do another movie. Congratulations. But the way you got there, by getting rid of so much, by sacrificing, by doing everything you could, has brought you to this moment where you have to produce something else with a lot of caveats, including the loss of one of your leading actors. And so tonight, I want to talk to you about this scrappy little movie which tries its best to succeed after its predecessor did so well, after it brought it back from the brink of extinction. Could it keep on going and notch a win so you could play another game, so you get another movie, another franchise, another series? Tonight, I'm Mike McCafferty, and I just want to talk about Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Okay, we can stop right there with the music, right? It's a little distracting to me because I get so caught up by James Horner's score. It's so beautiful, isn't it? He just picked right up where he left off in Star Trek II and just carried it on. And if nothing else, if you like nothing else about Star Trek III, you're going to love this music. But you know what? You love something about Star Trek III. I know that. I know that for a fact. So today I got back from the Magic Kingdom, Disney World, Orlando, Florida. We flew back. And I had known since I left that I was going to want to start focusing on the movies. It's been 138 podcasts that I have done on Star Trek, and I barely touched the movies because that for some reason I didn't want to, like, you know when you have that yummy piece of cake in the refrigerator, like, no, I don't want to eat it quite yet. I want to save it. I've been saving these. But then I did start to the motion picture, and I had so much fun, and you can listen to that previous podcast. I said, you know what? It's time. This summer, Discovery's over. I'm going to go through all the movies. I'm going to save Star Trek II. It's my favorite. I'm going to save it. It's that extra special piece of cake in the back of the refrigerator. But for the rest of them, I'm going to go through them, and you are going to listen to them. But I was in Disney World, and I just got back. And the weirdest thing was I was sitting in one of their buses that shuttle you all over the place. You're just basically like human meat that's being shuttled back and forth to all these different theme parks. And as I was going to Disney Hollywood Studios, previously MGM Studios, they were playing the Star Trek II music. Like the intro music was so weird. I look up, I'm like, oh. In fact, actually, Kiernan, my son, said, "Dad, listen to what they're playing." I'm like, "What are they doing?" Sure enough, they're playing the Star Trek II music. And it must have been because they licensed it out like decades ago. Because there's no way that Disney would license out different music. They're also playing music from the producers, Springtime for Hitler in Germany, like the orchestral version. So that was kind of like this weird legacy. Disney has all these weird legacy stuff, but it continued to get me thinking about how powerful Star Trek II was and how it saved the franchise. The entire franchise hinged upon that. And then they had to make another one. You know, in improvisation, you will put out something called an offer, where you say, "Oh, well, you know, the talking dog with the three robot legs is going to come through that door." And you have to honor that. If you invoke something, you have to pay it off. And Star Trek II certainly invoked a lot of different offers to the audience because they had nothing to lose. As I said before, they had 1/7 of the budget of the motion picture. And here they are, this scrappy little movie, which had nothing to lose, said, let's burn every bridge. I'll another side track here, but I do something called Channel 101 with Dan Harmon and all those people. Well, Dan Harmon doesn't do anymore, but I still do it once in a while. It's these little 5-minute films you make every month. And if the audience likes you, they'll vote you back. And people would always come to me and they say, "Hey, Mike, I've got these ideas for these shows. And episode 1 would be like this. And then episode 2, we do this. And episode 3, it'd be really cool that we do this." And immediately I know that's not going to succeed. Why? Because if you're saving anything for the next episode, you're dead in the water. You're dead in the water. Star Trek 3. Because you got to leave all your good ideas in that story. You've got to go all the way to the furthest you can go and make the audience say, "What now? What's beyond?" And then you figure that out. You sell the farm, and then you figure out where we're going to go from there. And Star Trek II certainly did that, didn't they? They killed off their major character, Mr. Spock. Gone, dead. But the show was a critical hit and a box office hit. But they did that because they had nothing to lose. There was nothing left on the table. Like, they have these sets and they have some spaceships laying around in some old, you know, storage. So let's make one more movie. Let's make one more and let's kill off Spock. Now let's just give him a fond farewell and see if we can kind of recoup some of that money we lost from the motion picture. Well, they made a ton of money. So much so that they said, "Let's make another one." And so they did. All right, I'm going to go to my notes now. Now, Star Trek II was the only film that came out. It would have been a very satisfying film as well. But it did, not only would have been a satisfying, like, let's say that it ended and there wasn't Spock dying, and it still did pretty well, the franchise still might be dead, to be honest with you. Let's say it made $100 million. Like, oh my gosh, well, you recouped all your money, good job. But you know what, you know, we're like 1 for 2 right now. We're going to say enough's enough. We'll throw that stuff in storage. And if we ever make a TV show in like 10, 20, 1,000 years, maybe we will. But the early 80s, late 70s had this interesting sort of, in the monoculture, we're calling it the monoculture now, aren't we? In the monoculture had this interesting thing that was going on where the whole country was being consumed by these little mysteries. Who shot JR? As parodied in The Simpsons, you know, who killed Mr. Burns is probably something you guys remember more, but who shot JR became this cultural thing, like, oh my gosh, who's Herb? Burger King. Unsuccessful, but you get the idea. Another one was The Empire Strikes Back. The Empire Strikes Back posed this terrible question of, oh my God, in 1980, oh my God, is Darth Vader, spoiler, really Luke's father? And I remember seeing it in the theaters going, no, No, it can't be. And if you weren't alive back then, let me tell you that the fervor and the fever which gripped people over that question of is Darth Vader Luke's father was cultural. It was huge. Now we accept it as fact. Now we understand that like the Star Wars universe is this tiny universe basically where like there's like 11 characters who circle around each other in perpetuity. And it's always going to be the rise and the fall of Skywalker. And that's fine. That's what that story is about. But at the time when Darth Vader said, no, I am your father, it shook everyone to their core. I'm not kidding. People were so freaked out. I was so freaked out. I didn't believe it. I remember Obi-Wan saying, well, it's true from a certain point of view. Like, what the... Well, he said that later, but what he said was that Darth Vader and Anakin went into a volcano and they fought, and only Darth Vader emerged. Like, oh, man, I remember that. That's something that happened. Or maybe I read it in the comics or the novelization. I don't remember. I liked Star Wars back then. I like Star Wars now. I love Star Trek. So, to follow those up, Star Trek, unwittingly, had its own mystery because they had killed off this character so tragically, so stunningly. It's hard to imagine. I mean, there's a couple other characters I can think of in the future. I don't want to spoil these things, but Harry Potter had one. But regardless, I don't think the audience was prepared for that level of shock to their system. Certainly I wasn't. And so it immediately begged the question, what are you going to do about that? How are you going to fix this? The audience, the people of this country as a collective, or perhaps as a science fiction collective, said, you have done the unthinkable. How will you unring this bell? We will pay you money to unring this bell. And so Paramount said, you bet. Because the answer to all things are money. And when they realized that there could be some money by somehow doing a show, which showed how to get Spock back, they could, first of all, do a regular Star Trek, like Star Trek 3, you know, like Into the Nebula. And they'd be like, oh, all right, that's fine, you know, make a little bit of money. But people would still say, but what about Spock? Spock is arguably one of the most famous characters of the 20th century. Now, whether he's the most popular of Star Trek is debatable between him and Kirk. And of course, now we've got Picard and Data and all those characters. But at the time, it was Spock. Spock was... you know, he was the guy. And you killed him. We gotta bring him back. So Paramount started to make the moves. Now, Star Trek III, as an overview, I'm gonna say this, and this is, I'm just going through my notes right now, is a movie made of protomatter. It is a movie which is cobbled together. It is not a bad movie. It's not a bad movie. Because there are parts of it which are good and parts of it which are bad. There's this odd-numbered curse you probably heard that like 1, 3, 5, 7, 9 are all terrible. Well, that's not true. 1 is terrible. 3 is okay. 5 is pretty bad. 7's not so great. 9's pretty bad. But you can't count them as it. You count the good ones. 2, 4, 6, 8. Yes. 10? 11, 12, 13? Mm-hmm. All right. So, but 3 falls in a weird category because 3 is many films. It's as though, as I said, it's like proto-matter in the movie where it is beautiful and delightful in the beginning and it starts marching along, but then eventually at some point in time, it starts to fall apart. Everything that made it beautiful, you find out, is built on this strange, unnatural substance which slowly starts to age and decay right before your eyes, that by the time the end of the film is there, it's kind of all gone. You still get what you want out of this, but that's my analogy. It's proto-matter. I'm just going to say it's proto-matter. But it's also a lot of things. It's a film about loss. It's a film about overcoming ageism. When I watched it today, I was like, oh, wow. That's really weird, but it is. It's true. It's a heist movie, and I've had a full-on podcast just about those 9 minutes stealing the Enterprise, and you can go back and listen to that. It's great. It's a movie about the Klingons and their obsession, their maniacal, idiotic obsession. It's a movie about friendship, of course. It's a movie about the dangers of science, and certainly we need to talk about the dangers of science these days, don't we? Well, not really very much anymore. But certainly back in the 80s, with nuclear bombs all over the place, that was a strong theme. What have you created, scientists? What hath God wrought? Now I become death. Now I am become death. I think that's what the quote is. Now, from my recollection, Star Trek III never... I don't think there was a very long time that people thought that Spock was actually dead. I'll just be honest. From my own recollection, as soon as they realized that Star Trek II made money, Paramount moved quickly. And the first thing they did, eventually, well, it was to secure Leonard Nimoy as the director. That's a big signpost saying that he's probably coming back. And of course, calling it The Search for Spock, if the search ends in failure, it's not a great movie. And I think they did that as sort of a soft landing. I think if they would have said, hey, there's a 30% chance he's not going to come back, I think the audience would have gone bananas. I think people would have said, how dare you bring him back? So even after the first 6 or 8 months of Star Trek II, they started laying the track for Spock's return. They understood that, wow, we really emotionally charged these people, and we're going to start laying the track to bring him back. And no one was upset with that. No one was upset that there was no subterfuge, that there's no Jonathan Harris, is that what his name is, who they faked us out as Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness. We wanted it. We demanded it. And they were like, yes, let's go ahead and do it. Now, as I said earlier, that Leonard Nimoy was tapped to be the director. Nicholas Meyer turned this down. He didn't know. He said himself, I don't know how to do resurrection movies. I said what I need to say in this movie. And you know what? I'm okay with that. I kind of wish he would have been part of this movie, because I think his sensibilities, although he is bombastic and kind of a goofball, and I did meet him at the last Star Trek screening. He was just kind of sitting there for like the 35th, just like enjoying, basking literally in the light from the screen that was beaming onto him. And I caught him, I shook his hand, I said, hey, I'm a big fan of this film, or I can't remember what I said, but coming in as an outsider, as a person who would have people tie sweaters around their backs, he added a certain sensibility and a certain gravitas to the show that I wish he had been there to mentor Leonard Nimoy on. Now, Leonard Nimoy was a pretty quick choice after Nicholas Meyer turned out. I think there was a guy named Goldstone who directed a couple of the original Trek episodes who had been considered. But as soon as they ventured it out, I think it was Michael Eisner, who was then, I can't remember, who was head of Paramount. They're like, yes, that is Leonard Nimoy to direct? Absolutely. Because it made so much marketing sense. So instantly he was in. He had directed before. He had directed a lot of TV shows before. So he was able to ask this. Not a bad thing, right? Now, one of the downsides about that is that because Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner had a favored nations contract between them, which said whatever one gets, the other one gets, the minute they made him a director, that meant that Shatner get to direct. And so we have, in one fell swoop, laid the groundwork for Star Trek III and Star Trek V. So there you go. In this film, Harv Bennett is the sole credited writer. He felt a little miffed that a lot of the screenwriting credit from the original one was kind of sapped away by Meyer, and there was a lot of like, well, who wrote this, who didn't? So he decided to jump in on this and just say, I'm going to be the writer for this. He wrote it in 3 weeks. Which I think was a mistake. He comes from TV. Harv Bennett came from TV, did $6 Million Man, did Bionic Woman, good shows. And under that pressure, I can tell you that you got to create content. Every week, you got a new episode. You got to crank it out. So even taking 3 weeks to write a script is luxurious. And he always thought it was ridiculous that filmmakers took so long to write scripts. And he had done it before with Star Trek II. But here's the problem, is with Star Trek II, he had existing scripts which he Frankensteined together. So he thought he could simply apply the same thing. Plus, he had a roadmap. He knew what he was going to do. Go find Spock. You have Genesis. You have Dead Spock. You have Kirk. You have the Katra. You have all these things that you're going to come up with. It's pretty, you know what the end of your film is. You're going to find Spock. So for him, he felt it was something which would be very easy to write and quickly to write. And he did. He wrote it in 3 weeks. I wish someone would have sat there with him. And Nimoy was also there too. Because I wish there was someone to slow them down and to say, let's take a breath and figure this out. Now, they weren't the only ones writing out. There were some other people jumping in. And the original version I see here in my notes had Spock's brother in it. Not Cybok, although, as we recall, Cybok does show up in Star Trek V, so I guess Favored Nations Clause, whatever is in one script will be in the other one. So Spock's brother shows up there. And we should also point out that Spock having a sibling has had very mixed results. I mean, I would say that Discovery, you know, with Michael Burnham has been okay, but I would say Spock made the show better rather than Michael Burnham making Spock better. So whenever they have a sibling in there, we can just leave that alone. It hasn't yielded the sweetest fruits. I wrote that down. Shatner was involved a little bit too. He read the script and he said on a Sunday, hey, come on over. Let's talk. Because he had a couple of questions too. Because at the time, the script was not as focused on him. Now the show is called The Search for Spock. So you got to find Spock. But as he had discovered, and as we had discovered in our previous podcast, is that if you don't have Kirk, the movie becomes sort of this Disneyland dark ride where you're just carried around from section to section with no one really leading it. You're on these rails looking at sequences. I know, because it was just at Disney World. The dinosaur ride is not that good, I'm going to be honest with you. But Everest, Expedition Everest, pretty good. Shatner knew that Star Trek 1 did not feature him as much as it should. Shatner knew that in Star Trek 2, even though it was about Spock and Kirk and Spock died, he was much more active. So when he had that meeting with Leonard Nimoy as the director and Harb Bennett, he said, listen, you guys, I think it should be about me. I'm the captain. And we have certainly seen in Discovery that without a captain, the show can kind of wobble. So he was right. And they were like, you know what? You're right, Bill. Let's have you make those difficult decisions because you're the captain. And in fact, that became the mandate for Star Trek IV. Make sure that he makes decisions. Now, sometimes it became almost ridiculous. Some scenes where he's not even supposed to be in the scenes, he's like, why can't I be in that scene? Well, because it doesn't make any sense, Bill. But I want to be in it. Well, you can't. He was very passionate about these things. And for Star Trek III and Star Trek IV, the mandate was put Bill in everything. Make him make all the difficult choices. And then for Star Trek V, for some reason, he decided to take himself out of those choices again and become a passenger to Cybok. Okay, so let's dive into the actual movie. All right, we have our main players. Everyone's been pulled back in, except for Carol Marcus. Carol Marcus, deemed expendable in this storyline. I don't necessarily disagree with it, because to have her in there starts to ask about, well, first of all, the whole protomatter thing, did she know about it? Second of all, you've got your ex-girlfriend and your son kind of lingering around in the show. So they had to get rid of somebody. Carol Marcus was the choice. This movie, as it starts out, has incredibly long exposition, longer than I think most movies would have today. It literally replays the Spock-Kirk scene where he's dying in the radiation chamber, antimatter chamber. It replays the whole thing, and it's a touching moment where it starts off in black and white and it slowly expands and then becomes into color. And then we hear Spock's narration carrying over in to see the Genesis or the Genesis planet and the Mark V torpedo sitting there. And then we go into the title sequence, which takes like 2.5 minutes. So it's about 5 minutes of exposition and titles before we even get to the story. I don't think you could do that. Think about like a movie like Endgame, which has 21 movies before it that you have to catch up to. And they just say, screw it. You've either watched the movies or you haven't. Actually, Endgame has a lot of similarities to Star Trek III. I'll talk about that a little later. The first part of this film is about grief. The crew's grief for the loss of Spock. Now, I was actually reading about this in the first 25 years of Star Trek, one of the books. And it is interesting that I never actually considered this, is that in Star Trek II, Kirk leaves off feeling young. I feel young. And it's a very hopeful, positive ending. And then we come back to him almost immediately, and he's sullen. He's like, oh, man, it sucks not having Spock here. Which is, you know, components of grief. You know, you can feel up, you can feel down. I feel like now the more I think about it, the more I think that this is a little bit of a, oh, I guess I just decided to dial him back a little bit. And certainly when you see him up top, you're like, oh no, is this going to be sullen the motion picture, Kirk? I certainly hope not. But I do like the sort of solemnness that the first part of this movie covers, which is, what do you do when a friend is gone? Plus, it gives us this badass line here. I've got to play this line here. Where is this? Let's just listen to this.
Sir, how else can I keep my reputation as a miracle worker?
Not that one.
Your reputation is secure, Scotty.
Mr. Sulu, take the car.
Not this one.
I'll be in my quarters.
Aye, sir. Sir? I was wondering, are they planning a ceremony when we get in? I mean a reception?
A hero's welcome, son. Is that what you'd like? Well, God knows it should be. This time we've paid for the party with our dearest blood.
Ah, what a good line. We paid for the party with our dearest blood. Whoever wrote that, that's a good one. Maybe it's, who knows, maybe it's Shakespeare. I don't know. But it's a good line, and it certainly epitomizes what this first section of this film is. Like I said, this film moves around quite a bit. It is a kind of a multi-headed beast of a movie. It can never quite figure out exactly what it wants to say. And this first part is, how do you mourn for someone that you've loved and lost for a long time? The next segment we get into, I want to talk about, is the Klingon bird of prey showing up. But it also begs into a larger comment about Star Trek III, which is that if there's any lasting legacy of Star Trek III, to be honest, it's the cool ships. I'm not kidding. Star Trek III had introduced the coolest ships of any of the Star Trek movies or any Star Trek series. I mean, think about it. You have the Klingon Bird of Prey, the Excelsior class, the Oberth class, and Space Dock 1. These are all home runs. These are all amazing ships. And just having one of them in this movie would be amazing. But instead you have four main characters. They are almost as lively characters as the cast is. The Warbird shows up first. It shows up with us. There is a little smuggler ship, which I think looks kind of dumb. But it shows up. It kind of like decloaks. Now we have to, as soon as you're watching it, like, I'm sure if you were a casual Star Trek fan, you're like, wait, did Klingons have cloaking technology? And you have to think back, oh, that's right. In third season, the Enterprise incident, one of the only good third season episodes, they switched. They gave the Romulans, I imagine, warp technology. They never said that, but, and the Klingons got cloaking technology. So they can cloak. Now what really happened in this movie is that originally it was going to be the Romulans who were going to be the bad guys. But then I think it was Nimoy who told Harv Bennett, you know what, the Klingons are a lot cooler. We should work with them. And so Harv went back and looked and said, you know what? And he watched all the episodes. You're right. Klingons are cooler. Let's go with that. But they already started building this Romulan warbird, this Romulan bird of prey. And so what are you going to do? I mean, it's even painted green like the later TNG Romulan ships. Well, you just call it a, you know, Klingon bird of prey and call it a day. But it is a beautiful ship, isn't it? I mean, it does look like this warbird, which has its forward swept wings that can go into three different actions. I'm doing the actions right now. I mean, when it's flying, it kind of has this middle, you know, kind of posture. When it's going to attack, it kind of lowers its little arms to shoot. And then when it's landing, it kind of kicks them up in the air so it can jettison out these gigantic landing gear. It's great. And it shows up and we see the Klingons. Our new Klingons. And I guess the other thing that this movie did was it sort of codified exactly what the Klingons were going to become. It gave us the template. Now, we had seen these new design Klingons in the motion picture for sure. But really, they didn't do a lot except bark out orders and shoot photon torpedoes at other photon torpedoes. So, you know, there's not a lot to go on off of that. But here, we finally got to see them as these ruthless space pirates, commanded by Captain Krug, Christopher Lloyd. Let's talk a little bit about Christopher Lloyd, shall we? Christopher Lloyd, as most of you know, is from Back to the Future, is Doc Brown. But before that, he did this. And before he did this, he did Taxi, where he vaulted to fame as Reverend Jim Ignatowski, even supplanting Andy Kaufman, if you can believe that. His character was actually more popular than Andy Kaufman. Now, Andy Kaufman kind of wanted out. He was kind of like, whatever. But I used to watch Taxi, and he was so great. He was so funny, Christopher Lloyd. And then he became a Klingon, and all I could see was this burnout taxi driver. There was a stand-up at the time who did like a joke of saying, can we believe that Christopher Lloyd is actually a Klingon? And he kind of was like acting as Jim Ignatowski as a Klingon.
Kirk, are you going to give me Genesis? Okie doke.
I didn't do it justice, but that's kind of what it was. And it, for me, it epitomized my problem. It's like, I'm just going to see him as this guy, as this kind of burnout taxi driver. He doesn't do a bad job. Let's be clear about that. He doesn't do a bad job, but this sort of falls into the larger problem of post-Khan villainry. After Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan came out, Khan was a cultural sensation as much as Darth Vader was back then. I mean, certainly he was bolstered by the fact that he was Ricardo Montalban, Mr. Rourke from Fantasy Island, but we had this Ahab-like villain, which we hadn't really seen in cinema before. I mean, maybe we have. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but certainly his take on it was so bombastic and yet so elegantly placed. It was operatic and yet cinematic at the same time. I don't know how that can be, but he set the template for villains for decades to come. We are still trying to create these Khan-like villains. And again, in Endgame and in Infinity War, we have this Thanos-like character who we've been slowly building up over and over and over dozens of movies. And Kevin Feige's a big Star Trek fan, so I'm not off when I say that he understood how to build this character slowly so that at least we had some sort of awareness of him. Khan was amazing. But the problem with other movies is that it's tough to build up a villain in one movie. They're often untethered to the lead. And if they are, then it again becomes this kind of tiny universe sort of situation where it's like, wow, you two guys are basically opposite sides of the coin. Got it. Good. Let's move on. I think Batman did a pretty good job with Jack Nicholson. So what we have here is this Klingon and the Klingon race. And again, we're still trying to figure out who they are. I don't know if the honor necessarily comes into play as strongly in this one, as much as it is, we just want to kill things and just like pillage, and honor was sort of not necessarily part of the equation. It probably wouldn't be until Star Trek VI and maybe even Next Generation where we really have got that nailed down, that Klingons are honor-based, which was, of course, a Romulan thing. I can almost imagine that this script, which had sort of an honorable warrior, Romulan, suddenly had these sort of echoes of honor in Christopher Lloyd's character. In this opening, we also have the death of his girlfriend, Valkris, which I didn't know as a kid. There's this weird Klingon woman in this smuggler ship. And as a side note, that smuggler ship looks terrible. The interior, it looks very TV. It, like, if you look at it, it's just like a couple of consoles set up, and there's like this really close wall, and there's nothing decorating it. It just looks like they just kind of threw it together, which they did. You know, they built these sets out of existing sets. The bar scene later on was from the sick bay. The Grissom was part of the Enterprise set. So it's again, they're penny-pinching here when they probably could have gone a little bit bigger, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But in this subplot, as they probably could have built up this character more, this Christopher Lloyd character, Commander Krug, by explaining to us that he was willing to kill his wife because she had seen this important document on Genesis. Now, why couldn't he just beam her up into his ship? I don't know. He certainly was adept at beaming people on and off planets. Why he couldn't beam her up off the ship and then blow up those guys is a mystery. And is sort of the first, like, wait, what's going on here? But it's designed to show us that they're ruthless. Instead, it comes off like they're not that smart. That they're just like, okay, you saw that? I'm just going to kill you. And she's like, great, sounds like a plan. See you later. But at least we get the Targ, right? The Klingon dog that looks like a puppet. It was a puppet. We all knew it was a puppet back then. It's this like puppet dog that's right next to his side, and we imagine there's a guy's arm sticking through it. But we got the Klingon Targ. Okay, we got that. Next, as I said, the ships are almost the lead of this movie. We get the space dock. The space dock is so badass. Let's see if I can pull that up. Here we go. Oh, this beautiful mushroom-like ship.
Approach control. This is Enterprise. Ready for docking maneuvers.
Enterprise is cleared to dock.
Lock off.
And these little doors open up on the mushrooms.
System's locked.
And they slowly move towards it.
Space dock, you have control.
Affirmative, Enterprise. Enjoy the ride and welcome home.
Enterprise confirms.
We have this grand shot of the Enterprise being dwarfed by this gigantic space dock, listed as being 5 miles long, as it slowly and majestically moves inside these space doors. And then inside this mushroom spinning top thing, which rotates for reasons I don't understand, is this giant shipyard with other ships there. It was gigantic. I don't know why you had to put spaceships inside other spaceships that are that large. I mean, like, there's not space weather to worry about. But damn, is it cool.
Would you look at that?
Would you look at that?
My friends, the great experiment. Excelsior.
All right, lot to unpack there. Let me just pull back up these things. So, we go through the space dock, which again has become an iconic part of Star Trek. It's seen in The Next Generation because they basically reused the footage and just overlaid the Enterprise D on it. So, hey, you gotta save some money, right? But why not? Because it's this beautiful 5-mile-long world. We could do an entire series in the space dock, and I'd be like, yes, let's do that. The entire sequence is a treat for Star Trek fans because, first of all, it gives us two sets of scale. First, the giant Enterprise going into the mammoth space dock. Suddenly we get this sense of scale because we know how big the Enterprise is. We've all pictured in our heads. And suddenly it's being engulfed by this Federation space station. It gives us the scale of the Federation as well as the Enterprise itself. As it being swallowed up by this, like Pinocchio being swallowed by the whale. Disney. But then secondly, we get this other little bonus. As we pass by the Excelsior, we'll talk about the Excelsior in a minute, as it pulls into its space dock port and it goes past the little space restaurant. There's a space restaurant in this show. It's pretty amazing. And everyone stands up and sees the damage. And it's these giant windows and the Enterprise pulls alongside and you get the sense of scale of how big the Enterprise is. So in one sequence, we see how small the Enterprise is and how big the Enterprise is. And we get to see fake Marion Ross. I've talked about this before, but a woman stands up and she looks at the Enterprise's damage and she's like, oh no. She shakes her head. And for the longest time, I thought that was Happy Days' Marion Ross. It's not. It's Grace Lee Whitney with red hair. To this day, I look at them. I will post pictures on the website. We have a Facebook page. Check that out. And I'm sure that that's Marion Ross, but it's not. It's Grace Lee Whitney giving a cameo. And good for her. Now let's talk about the Excelsior for a hot second here. The Excelsior is the true star of that scene, for sure. The Excelsior, when I saw it, oh man, it was so beautiful. the makers of these ships, and to be honest, I haven't researched who made the ships in this past, kind of took a sort of a very literal sense of like nautical ships. We'll see the Orbith class look like a Viking longboat sort of in the water. And this has this secondary hull, which looks like an old British steamer. It's giant, it's fat, it's got big protruding nacelles out there and an oversized saucer section. But damn, it looks good. It is one of the best looking starships they've ever made. Even better than, the Enterprise D. There's always been this desire to see more of that. And certainly in Star Trek VI, we see it again. You know, there's always been this desire to put Sulu on the Excelsior. For some reason, there was something about seeing this ship, which is bigger and larger than the Enterprise, less elegant, but more powerful, which, at least for me as a kid, thrilled me. It's sort of like in the Empire Strikes Back, the Scout Walkers. Remember the Scout Walkers? If you watch The Empire Strikes Back, you will see the Scout Walkers for about 3 seconds. They walk by in the frame, in the background of the frame. You see all these giant walkers, boom, 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 boom. And then you see tick, 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 this little chicken-like robot walk by. Like 3 seconds, that's all. But it captured our imagination. And so because of that, now there's Scout Walkers everywhere. That's just the way these things roll. The same thing with the Excelsior. That same level of excitement. It was like, we have to see more of this. Now, as soon as they dock, they find out that they can't talk about the whole Genesis experiment. Because in the interim, Genesis has become this political football, basically, between the Klingons and the Federation. Basically, the Klingons have viewed this as like an atomic test. And of course, remember, we're in the early 80s when Russia and America were exploding bombs underground or underwater or in the air to show their military superiority. They were showing, I can blow you up better than you can blow me up. And they would trade these off, these gigantic, like, you know, hundreds of megaton bombs. And so suddenly the Federation has this thing which can destroy a whole planet with one bomb. And it has freaked out the Klingons. So they can't go back there, and they can't talk about it, which is too bad because Bones is losing his marbles because Spock has put his marbles in his brain. But before we go into that a little more, we have to zip over to the Genesis planet with the USS Grissom. Now, the nice thing, that the Grissom is also a pretty cool ship. Now, it's probably like third or fourth in my favorite of this movie, but it's still pretty cool. And the nice thing about Federation ships is they all have saucer sections. And saucer sections are nice. Saucer sections. They're nice because you can judge the scale of it. For a long time, I didn't know how big the Klingon Bird of Prey was because it appeared in different sizes. And so when they said there's a complement of 12 on that, it's like, really? It looks like it's the same size as the Enterprise. But when you get these saucer sections, you can kind of judge and say, oh, that one's bigger than the Enterprise. That one's smaller. So you can kind of get a sort of a scale. Generally, they're all a similar size, but you can see when it's a little smaller, a little bit bigger. And we got the Grissom, but instantly you can tell that it's smaller and it's more of a research vessel. And let me play this little clip here of our characters. I know this is quiet, but it's okay. Don't want to create a wall of sound for you. But, okay, now the Genesis planet. Stardate 82-10.3. Probably 1982, October. 3rd of October, this was done.
We have reached the destination planet at point 035.
Very well, Lieutenant. Helm? Execute standard orbital approach.
Standard orbit, aye, sir.
Communications. Send a coded message for Starfleet Commander, Priority 1. Federation Science Vessel Grissom arriving. Genesis Planet, Mutara Sector to begin research. JTS to Bond Commanding.
Aye, sir. Coding now.
Dr. Marcus, it's your planet.
Begin scanning, please.
This is where the fun begins, Savick.
Just like your father. So human.
Okay, let's unpack a whole bunch of that. So first of all, we have the Oberth class Grissom flying towards the Genesis planet, and we have Captain Esteban, who is one of my favorite captains. And then we cut to a shot of David Marcus, Merritt Buttrick, who reprised his role from Star Trek II. And then we get Savick, Lieutenant Savick, but not Kirstie Alley. Instead, it's Robin Curtis. Now, there's a lot of different ruminations as to why Kirstie Alley wasn't in the Star Trek III. Some said that she didn't want to be typecast. Some said that her agents mishandled the negotiations. Some said that she wanted as much money as Shatner to appear in this. You know, if she's the female lead, I guess I don't blame her that much, right? I mean, if she's the number one female on the list, sure, give her the same amount of money. For whatever reason, Kirstie Alley did not appear in Star Trek III, which I feel is a major detriment, because all of a sudden, in the middle of trying to track all these characters, as they're trying to find Spock, we have to come to grips with there being a new Savick, a new Vulcan. Additionally, Robin Curtis, although she's a good actress, decides to play this far more Vulcan than human, or Romulan, for whatever you want. Kirstie Alley had this really wonderful, sensual take on being a Vulcan. I mean, it was in the script, she was like a quarter Romulan or something like that. So she had the capacity to feel feelings. But regardless, there was a sensuality to her, and I'm not trying to sexualize this, but there certainly was this eminence she gave off. This she radiated something about her, which translated into this, which gave such a new perspective on Vulcans that we hadn't seen before, and it was refreshing. With Leonard Nimoy directing Robin Curtis, and she was brand new, just kind of landed in L.A., and boom, I'm Lieutenant Savick. It became much more of a Vulcan role. And of course, why not? You know, that's all that Spock knew how to do. I'm sorry, Leonard Nimoy knew how to do. To me, it was a lost opportunity. And I think I think Harv Bennett said it was kind of a wash. I disagree. I feel as though there was a lot of opportunity to flesh out that character, especially a character whose mentor had passed away and she very soon is becoming in contact with him. We'll get to that a little later on. It was such a disjointed thing that they skipped over a lot of Savick beats in the rest of the franchise. Basically, that was the movies 4 and 6, to the point where they basically just didn't even have Savick in 6, even though the character was there for her. Instead, it was played by Samantha from Sex and the City. I can't remember her name right now. They basically did away with it. But there's also something that rings a little untrue as well. I don't know if you caught it when she says, just like your father, so human. She just met these people. And to be having a slight smile, it's the only time she really smiles, it just seems out of character. How does she know these characters so well? I mean, she barely knows Kirk. She barely knows, David. Why should she have these assumptions as a Vulcan? But that's okay, because we need to clear the path for Esteban, the most cautious and by-the-book captain of Starfleet. You know, for our story, it's very lucky that he does follow the rules so much, because otherwise they would have beamed up Spock much earlier and the Klingons would have destroyed them all. End of the show. All right, let's go back to absent friends. Kirk toasting the loss of Spock. Absent friends is one of the toasts that they give in the British military on Sundays, actually. And it's usually by the lowest ranking officer. So instead of Kirk, it would probably be like Chekhov, I guess, or maybe Sulu giving to absent friends. But again, we're just starting to leave this mourning phase of the movie. It's interesting how this has still continued on here. And then we have the visitation by Sarek, who kind of dresses down Kirk for not bringing his sons Katra back to Mount Salea. Now, Bones earlier said, you know, climb the steps of Mount Salea. And Kirk's like, what? What do you mean? Well, now we understand a little more. That every Vulcan has the ability to do kind of like a time machine for their brain, an Apple Time Machine and plug in to a hard drive, download your consciousness into another being. God, that's frightening, isn't it? And then that being takes it up to the steps of Mount Celea, where I guess they put it into something. I guess in Discovery, didn't we see like all those faces in the rocks or something? I mean, is that where do you go? I mean, what happens to this collective consciousness? Does it all filter in? You know, is it kind of like the great collective of the, you know, of Odo's people? I don't know. But for this instance, we realize that he didn't put it in Kirk. He put it in McCoy. And so now we have our story. You have to rescue McCoy, or you have to get McCoy to the Genesis planet. Although why they're going to Genesis, because they think he's dead, it's not quite certain. But for some reason, they have to go. They just have to go to Genesis. It doesn't matter. Go to Genesis. Because at this point in time, they don't know that Spock is alive. I'm just realizing this myself. Again, the proto-matter of this film is starting to break apart. Now, I used to have a problem with Discovery having that sort of intergalactic FaceTime of Sarek where he could talk to Michael Burnham like over great distances. And maybe I still do. But then I remember also that they invoked this Katra thing kind of out of nothing. It's like, oh, it's his Katra. We never mentioned it before. The Vulcans have this infinite amount of interesting things they can do with their minds when it's necessary. All right, let's go to one of the best lines of the entire film. I'm sorry you're hearing these little clicks, but damn it. All right, here we go. Just met with Admiral Morrow. Over drinks, asking to go to Genesis, and Morrow says, no way.
You'll destroy yourself. Do you understand me, Jim?
I hear you. I had to try. Of course. Thanks for the drink.
Anytime.
The word, sir?
The word? Is no. I am therefore going anyway.
You can count on our help, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Sulu. I'll need it.
Shall I alert Dr. McCoy?
Please, he has a long journey ahead of him.
Now at last we have fun Kirk. Kirk who's willing to bend or break the rules in order to get what he wants. And all he has to do now is get McCoy, who is resting comfortably at his house. Or is he? Perhaps he's at the Goofball Space Dock Space Bar. Paramount had been chasing, trying to emulate Star Wars as best as it could, certainly in the first movie. It tried to capture all that space opera. It also created a whole bunch of weird space aliens, which actually, if you go to the Facebook page, you can see some pictures posted by one of our astute friends of the pod from one of the album covers, all these weird aliens that didn't exist in the movie, but they just kind of created them. And so here they're trying again to emulate Star Wars by creating sort of a cantina bar with all sorts of weird aliens, except they didn't seem to really have the budget. As I said before, they used the sick bay and redressed it as a space bar. So already they're in the hole by just making a bunch of walls and putting a couple of tables up. Again, it feels like a TV set because it's sort of like a two or three walls. It's like almost like two walls, like a two-wall set, like a corner. It's just it's a weird set. But this is where McCoy goes to try to get passage to Genesis. He knows his brain is now filled with so much Spock. He knows he has to go to Genesis. He has to go back there for some reason and get something. All these people seem to realize he needs to get to Genesis, even though they don't know why. But his first stop is at this crazy space bar. And I love this space bar because it's so half-assed. You've got like one and a half weird aliens. You got a guy who looks like a Arium robot from Discovery. You have this woman who sort of has some makeup on, kind of not. And then you got this weird guy. There's this guy, if you watch this movie, behind McCoy when he enters, there's this guy in this cadet outfit. And I spent a lot of time watching him. Now, as McCoy enters, there's this dude in this cadet outfit. And first of all, he like bumps into McCoy like very like purposely. He's like, boom, oh, sorry. Like he was instructed to bump into McCoy. Then he sort of stares at this robot-headed dude who just walks off. And then this alien woman enters and looks around. She sees the cadet, but just kind of like scans though she's looking for someone. And then she instantly recognizes the cadet because she was instructed to do so, the cadet puts his arm around her and they walk off. It's so weird. They cut up the sequence because you see McCoy enter, then cut to the room, then back to McCoy, then back to the room, back to McCoy. But if you put all those sequences together, it's a bizarre interaction with this guy. He is by far the most interesting thing there. Next to, of course, the holographic biplane fight. As I said, they're trying to do their best to do a little bit of Star Wars and have that three-dimensional chess with the monsters. So they had three-dimensional biplane fights because in the 23rd century, all you want to do is get in a simulator little thing to play with biplanes. That's the most exciting thing. McCoy rolls in there with this amazing outfit. He's wearing this leather jacket that seems to have two collars, like a secondary auxiliary collar in it. He has this white breastplate kind of vest thing. It looks like it's almost like a diving suit kind of thing. And then he's got an ascot. Oh, damn it. He's kicking ass already. He goes in there, meets the waitress. She's all into him. He's like, I'm looking for something. Well, you're never looking for me because I'm always here. Like, she wants him. And she's got this weird, glowy little outfit. It looks like they all robbed the TV show Buck Rogers costume department because all these costumes are terrible. They're all terrible. I got to be honest. It's really bad. And then he meets this goofball monster to try to get passage. And this guy's always bugged me. I mean, I'm sure he's a nice guy. He's probably a really good actor. But there's just something about his over-the-top performance. Let's just listen a little of this.
All right, damn it. It's Genesis. The name of the place we're going is Genesis.
Genesis?
Yes, Genesis. How can you be deaf with ears like that?
Genesis allowed is not. Is planet forbidden.
Look, backwards, friend. Genesis may be planet forbidden, but I'm damn well...
Sir, I'm sorry, but your voice is carrying.
No, that dude's voice is carrying. That crazy alien. It's just called Alien. Alan Miller. He's probably a nice guy. I should probably see if he's still alive. I can get him on the pod. But it's this weird Yoda backwards speak. You know, your planet, welcome. I'm like, ah. It's just, and his makeup is just, it's just kind of sloppy. And then this guy from Federation Security shows up and he's wearing this kind of like weird pajama outfit from Lost in Space. Ah, there's just so much. There's so much right and so much wrong with this sequence. But it does create the complication that we can't just get McCoy because now he's in a Federation funny farm. Now they have to rescue him. Now the heist is afoot. They have to get a ship. They have to get McCoy and they have to get out of there without anyone seeing them. Now I talked about the whole stealing the Enterprise sequence. We're here, so I won't talk about it that much more. Because we had this, you can go check out that podcast. I do want to point out that Chekhov's little Dutch boy outfit with the big white collar. It's magnificent, but you only see it in one section because as soon as they saw it on him with the other cast members, and they all look like goofballs. It's like a weird like banana splits kind of like 70s and 80s costuming. They got rid of his little Dutch boy collar because it was too much. He's wearing a pink outfit with a big white collar that's like 9 inches long. So let's skip over that. They get the Enterprise. They escape. And then we start going back to Planet Soundstage, the Genesis planet. One of the things as this movie starts to break apart, much like Genesis, is that they chose to shoot on a soundstage instead of on location. One of the location directors wanted to shoot in Hawaii. What a great idea that would have been, to shoot in Hawaii. All this great, like real foliage and real mountains to climb on. And amazing. But it was deemed to be too expensive. And again, this goes back to Paramount's or Harve Bennett's television thinking. We can just do it all on a soundstage. Let's just build it all there. The problem is that we'd seen that a dozen, you know, dozens of times before on the original series. And so we could spot a fake. And when they're on this planet... This planet, I'm using air quotes so you can... Did you hear that? I was using air quotes. I was using this planet. We all knew that it was just a soundstage. And so from that point on, it started to feel less and less real. As David and Savick find young Spock, and they're running around through all these ferns, which have been placed by Paramount, you know, the foliage department. There's a cactus at one point in time when they're talking to, when they find young Spock, and it's got snow all over it, but you can see the texture. It's like this grid-like texture of where the snow has been sprayed on. It's just a level of TV sloppiness, which, again, if you're making a TV show and you crank this one out, hey, episode 21, The Search for Spock, great, got it, we're done. Episode 22, you know, Spock owns a barbershop, great, we love that one. But this is a movie. This lasts forever. And here we are, 30 plus years, still talking about it. So you better make damn well sure that everything is in its place. Otherwise, jackasses like me are going to talk about it on podcasts. All right, so by this point in time, Krug has accidentally destroyed the Grissom, and David and Savick have found young Spock. And this is where I feel like we've missed a second part of an interesting subplot. So Christopher Lloyd's character, Commander Krug, has lost his wife, and Savick has lost a mentor in Spock. There's a moment where they come to the casket of Spock, and they see the weird, like, amoeba things, you know, swirling around, like, that have been evolving. And they just sort of look at it with the casket with sort of disinterest. And then David opens it, and they don't find anything. And Savick grabs his robe. It's empty. There's nothing in the robe. There's no body. And there's no reaction to her. She has no opinion of this either way. In the Star Trek II, Kirstie Alley's Savick cried at the end of this. She cried at the end of this movie either because she was mourning the loss of her mentor, because she had a crush on him or whatever, or because it was just a fellow creature. Tears came out of her eyes. But here, this Savick can only look, there's no look on her face. Like, I watch and she just kind of grabbed the cloak and said, okay, there we go. She is more of a mother figure or of a great aunt or someone who's eventually going to have sex with him. Keep that in mind. That's going to be weird. Krug finds mutated bacteria, which is now turning these weird tentacle creatures, and for no apparent reason, he wrestles with them, and then kills them. In fact, he waves off his guys, who are like, oh, we got to help our commander. He's like, no, I'm going to kill these things. I don't know if he was looking for a new pet or what, but it's such a weird, bizarre scene which has no explanation other than he walks up and sees these weird snake-like things, picks up one, it wraps around him, starts to choke him, and almost chokes him to death, and then he kills it. Now, I think it's trying to show that these Klingons are ruthless and that they enjoy the idea of death, but we don't learn any of that. And to this point, he just seems like a goofball who either courts death or doesn't really have a strong plan. It's here also that we learn that David has used protomatter, which is an interesting plot point, which I think only serves to age up Spock. It has an interesting consequence of the perils of science gone too far. Again, we're talking about nuclear weapons and protomatter being kind of akin to how big of a bomb you can build. So maybe I amend that. I mean, there is value to this, but the main plot point is to continue to age up Spock. It does beg the question of why didn't Phase 1 and Phase 2 of the Genesis Project not also disintegrate? They were sitting in the cave of Phase 2, and they'd been in there for a while. I mean, at least long enough to do it, and then to go back to the station and sit around and not notice any sort of problems here in this planet. I mean, it's only there for a little while, and boom, it's gone. I guess you can sort of rationalize it by saying the bigger the amount of protomatter, the quicker the reaction, but that's just me filling in the gaps when the story writer should have done it, when Harv Bennett should have spent a couple more weeks answering those questions. We then get to what I was inferring to earlier, which is that as Spock is growing older, we have a Ponfar moment. Now, Ponfar was in Amok time. Every 7 years, like the salmon swimming upstream, Vulcans must mate. And so every 7 years of Spock's body, he must mate. I don't understand the subplot. I really don't. He goes through this kind of like We see him as a teenager at this point in time, and Savick identifies, oh, he's going through Ponfar. He's having these, I mean, it's he's going through puberty, like sexual awakenings. And so the first time they solve it by doing their little finger thing, they do a little finger thing, the Vulcans. It's not gross. Just go watch Amok Time or Return to Babel, where they place two fingers over two fingers and they kind of like swirl them around each other. And it's all in public and it's all fine. And that sort of symbolizes kind of love and affection. That's how the Vulcans show that. And so Robin Curtis shows young Spock that. And he's like, oh, okay. Because right now his mind is empty. He's just kind of like looking and observing. I guess his mind's developed to the point where he can understand and, you know, is not like soiling himself and all that sort of stuff. Weird things I think about. But there's inferences, especially in Star Trek IV, that Savick was pregnant with Spock's baby. Now, I don't know when they hooked up. Maybe they hooked up after he got his mind back. Maybe they hooked up now. I don't know, but why would they introduce this Ponfar thing where he's going through the sexual cycle? It's not something that anyone is tracking, and yet we do this. So did she have sex with him? I never thought about it until recently, and I don't want to think about it now because it's so strange. But in Star Trek IV, there was a scene where Savick decides to stay on Vulcan because she is pregnant with Spock's baby. So obviously, at some point in time, she had feelings for him. Which then leads back to Star Trek III, is that when she sees the cloak, why does she not have feelings for that when she sees that he's gone? Why would she not have feelings for Spock when she sees him there as a young boy, as she mentors him through Ponfar? I mean, what an amazing sensual moment, or non-sensual moment, or mentoring moment, where the student mentors the master. There are so many different things that can happen, but instead it's just rushed along as a science fiction-y kind of event where no one has any sort of reaction to it. All right, so meanwhile, the Enterprise is steaming towards the Genesis planet, and they can't reach the Grissom because right now it's been destroyed. And we have another interesting, clever moment of the crew and Kirk where they figure out that a spaceship is coming. And they figure out there's a spaceship. Let's see, what is this? There it is, 10305.
There. That distortion, see it?
Yes, sir. It's getting larger as we close in.
Firing range, sir.
Played by John Larroquette. Ahoy!
Doshi Bosh!
Neh! This is a nice sequence because it shows off Kirk and Sulu and the rest of the crew being clever again, using their wits.
Opinion, Mr. Sulu.
I think it's an energy surge.
Enough energy to hide a ship, would you say?
A cloaking device.
Red alert, Mr. Scott.
Hey, Sam.
These Klingons have the drop on them, but they, with their experience,
all power to the
weapon sussed
systems.
Out that the ship is coming for them.
Wage.
And they have one shot to get to them.
No shields? My guess is right, they'll have to decloak before they can fire.
May all your guesses be right.
Well, what's a Spock thing?
One violent telecom.
Cyrus!
The decloak. So cool.
Klingon bird of prey, sir. She's arming torpedoes. Fire, Mr. Scott.
Listen to this. Listen to that crescendo. The music builds up to that.
Good shooting, Mr. Scott.
Those horns, the signalers, James Horner signaling away, and his Targ dies.
Precautionary, Mr. Chekhov. Shields up.
The ship is listing to its right, spinning away. Crew picks up his Targ as it circles around and he says, I did a whole podcast on what he said right there. For the longest time, I thought he said Kirk Busters. You can go listen to it. It's one of my best podcasts. It's one of my most topical podcasts. But you know that blue dress and that gold dress they had before where you could look at it one way and see it another way? I was watching this on the airplane with the subtitles on and I was listening to it, and I swear to you, when he says emergency power to the thrusters, I heard that. And then when I turned it off and I wanted to hear Kirk Busters, I could hear Kirk Busters. So you know what? I think it's either way. I think he said Kirk Busters, but I think everyone hears a emergency power to the thrusters. One of the things I forgot to mention is the idea of ageism. And certainly in the early part of the film, as Kirk was feeling old in the first movie, most of the characters are being presented with the fact that they're old and they're outdated as well. And this is almost like Roadhogs in space, where they all these old people kind of get together, use their experience and guile, and overtake the young and the established to defeat them. And this is another one of those instances where these people, through experience, see that as being a cloak ship and are able to use their guile to defeat this ship, which has the drop on them. All right, next we get the standstill between the two of them, which, you know, I guess it's okay. It feels as though sometimes this script is working towards interesting beats as opposed to organically flowing to interesting beats. We have the sacrifice of David. Commander Krug says, if you don't surrender, I'll kill these three guys on the ship or on the planet. If you don't surrender your entire ship, and then we'll kill one of them. Now, he does get a chance, David does get a chance to talk to Kirk. He says, what went wrong? I went wrong. There are parallels between both of them cheating to get what they want. It's too bad they didn't compare notes on that. That would have been a nice moment. Really, David and Kirk never meet again, which is sad, until he's dead and he puts a jacket over his head. But David sacrifices himself to save Savick. So does David love Savick, but Savick loves Spock? At one point in time, there was going to be a subplot where Savick was falling in love with Kirk later on. Who does Savick love? Who loves Savick? And how come no one loves Uhura? She's beautiful. I loved Uhura. I interviewed her one time, and she was so beautiful. My God, she was like 60 at the time, and I was like 35. And I, oh my God. That seems weird. That seems very Ponfari. That's not. She was a striking, beautiful woman. But we do get to that beautiful moment of, you Klingon bastard, you killed my son, where Kirk stumbles and falls backwards. Is this moment earned? I don't know. We've only known David for a couple of movies, literally, and he's only had actual contact with his son in maybe two to three scenes. And in this movie, zero scenes. So how much does that earn? How much is he really, what is he looking at here? At the end of the film, there's a line. Well, we'll talk about that later. But he says, at what cost? Sarek says, at what cost? Your ship, your son. And it's true. Because the next thing he's going to do is he's going to sacrifice his ship. All in the name of saving Spock. He does all of this. So really, he puts family and the Federation ahead or behind his love for his friend of Spock. Let me get to this point here. This is one of my favorite lines here. I'm just going to play this one because for years we've imitated this. Here we go. So the Klingons have beamed onto this empty ship, and Krug says they're hiding. Impossible, they must be hiding. And the guy on the ship says, yes, sir. Like, there's 400 people hiding on the Enterprise. Like, it's a giant game of hide and seek. So they beam on board the Enterprise. They're all looking around. Meanwhile, the self-destruct has been invoked, as we saw that and let that be the last battlefield. It's counting down from 60 seconds. Another cool set piece that I think they just were trying to get to because it was a cool set piece. These space pirates are running around, and they get into the bridge, and it's empty.
My lord, the ship appears to be deserted.
How can that be? They're hiding.
Yes, sir. But the bridge seems to be run by computer. It is the only thing speaking.
Speaking? Let me hear.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5.
Get out!
Three,
get out of there!
Me and the doctor and Chief Engineer McCarris love saying, get out! Get out of there! And you know, if you ever go into a room that has a countdown, you should get out. What we have now is this fantastic destruction of the universe, which I feel is something that they built up to just because from a visual aspect, it is absolutely gorgeous. Now, why they had to do it, I'm not quite sure. Beam those guys on, beam them into a brig or something like that, or place a force field around them. But we get this beautiful shot of it falling into the atmosphere. And then we get this great exchange between McCoy and Kirk. I love this exchange because it really epitomizes exactly who Kirk is. As I stare at this fireball crossing the sky.
My God, Bones. What have I done?
What you had to do. What you always do. Turn death into a fighting chance to live.
McCoy is the unsung hero of this movie to some degree. He kind of gets the short end of the stick on this because even though he has Spock's brain, because the mandate was to circle this around Kirk, and because you have all these other subplots of Commander Krug and David and David and Savick, we kind of shortchange McCoy. And McCoy is always the MVP of all these movies because he's in there with that humanity. And he gives Kirk that spark right there. What have I done? What you had to do, what you always do. You turn death into a fighting chance to live. And that's what we want to see from Kirk. So if nothing else, it's been at least, and we saw that in Star Trek II, at least it's been verbalized here. Did they have to sacrifice David? Did they have to sacrifice the Enterprise? Why did they have to sacrifice those two? Just to get some sort of shock value, to have some sort of stakes? Possibly. I mean, if we knew we were bringing back a character, don't we have to sacrifice one? Conceivably. Why not Savick? I mean, it's a different actress already. Why get rid of this familial relationship that with Kirk that's just starting to bud? As a result of this film, Leonard Nimoy said, I don't want any deaths in Star Trek IV when he directed. I don't want any villains in Star Trek IV. Turned out to be a good call. We'll talk about that one later. Now, when we return to Krug later on, we don't find out that Krug is not upset. I just want to put this in for losing his crew, but because Kirk beat him. Again, this is something which is never said in the movie. It's mentioned in the script, but not in the movie. We just see him, his hands in his face. He seems upset. And we infer as humans that he's upset because he lost his crew, because Kirk got the better of him and blew himself up. And it's a tragic loss of his crew. But in fact, he's upset because Kirk got the better of him. But we never see that. Now we're almost completely on Planet Soundstage, which almost caught on fire. There's a famous story about how one of the nearby soundstages caught on fire. And William Shatner grabbed basically a garden hose and tried to put out the fire. And they took a picture of it and it looked very dramatic. In fact, he didn't really help that much at all. But it was good for publicity for the show. And it's like, my God, he's doing everything. And of course, for William Shatner, he loves that. He's getting stem cell treatment to try and get younger. I hope he does. I hope he lives to be 1,000. My God. As the planet continues to evolve and catch on fire and violently shake itself apart, so does Spock. His face turns into 80s prosthetics with all those little bubbling bladders in his skin. He looks like he's from an American Werewolf in London, everything bubbling and coming out of him. And then finally, Kirk tricks Krug into coming down to get them. He beams up most of the crew, but not Kirk and not Spock, because Kirk wishes it. And then we have the climactic fight. Let's play that, shall we? Here we go.
I'm waiting for you. What is your answer?
Planet is breaking apart. Soundstage has fake rocks falling everywhere. There's a little waterfall I never noticed. Spock cries in pain, everyone looks, and then.
Drop all weapons! Over there! All but Kirk!
I should point out that long before Seinfeld talked about the puffy pirate shirt, Kirk has a puffy pirate shirt.
Bones! prisoners have beam coordinates.
You should take the Vulcan too.
No!
But why?
Because you wish it.
Well, again, that doesn't make much sense.
Monk! Cho-yichu!
His name is Maltz. John Merrick's name is Maltz. Maltz Liquor. Now here's the exchange, which doesn't
Genesis.
Make a lot of sense.
I want it!
Beam the Vulcan up. And we'll talk.
Give me what I want, and I'll consider it.
This is already.
You fool, look around you!
You fool.
The planet's destroying itself!
Yes, exhilarating, isn't it?
If we don't help each other, we'll die here.
Perfect. Then that's the way it shall be.
What is that exchange all about? It's such this... I can't describe it, but it is just nonsensical parroting back and forth of, give me what I want, you can't have it, then I'll kill you, we'll both die, that sounds great.
Give me Genesis!
To his own death, he just keeps on parroting this idea. We saw this last movie with Khan, but Khan was much more clever about it. Yes, he wanted Genesis, and he eventually got it because he did it through clever means. This is just this brute force over and over again. Give me what I want. Give me what I want. Again, in some ways, it's a little bit like Thanos in Endgame. It's a little bit like Thanos in Infinity War, but he has more machinations to do it. This is just over and over again, just screaming at him, give me Genesis, with nothing to incentivize Kirk to do it. And when Kirk says no, his solution is just to punch him and to fight him in this lava field until he dies. Now, if he was motivated by the death of his wife, or the death of his Targ, or by honor, or by Klingon code, or by something, I could understand that. But in this fight, he's just fighting to fight. And so we have this sort of ridiculous fight. And it makes you appreciate Star Trek II even more. Because Star Trek II never had a face-to-face confrontation of Khan and Kirk. They did that in Space Seed. And Kirk barely beat him. They didn't need to do it again. There's no reason for this fight right now. We've already decided it. He's not going to give them the information. They'll die together. So instead they have this ridiculous fight on this bad sound stage with lava. It sort of looks like Lord of the Rings right now. They're kind of fighting over with Gollum. And then Christopher Lloyd sort of like stumbles a little bit, falls down, and is hanging by his fingers from a ledge, which I hate that trope as well. Upper body strength is never that strong. Kirk asks for his hand to help him up, and instead, Krook pulls him down. And then Kirk says,
I have had enough of you!
And he kicks him into the lava. Now, originally, they talked about him saying, this is for David, which would make it even more nonsensical because he barely knew David. And so why is he asking for revenge? He should say, this is for Spock. I have had enough of you is a trope which has been used many times in different TV shows. In fact, South Park.
That's it! I have had enough of you!
In the South Park movie, the devil throws Saddam Hussein into a pit of lava. Just like Star Trek. It's such an over-the-top line. But unlike Khan, where everything he does has merit and has this 15-year backstory, this guy is doing stuff for reasons we don't understand. Again, I wish the script had a little more time to ferment, to put all those little tendrils of backstory in. Of logic, a plot, so that we could understand why this character is punching Captain Kirk above a lava field instead of beaming him back up to his ship and said, okay, I'm going to keep you in this cell and torture you and your friends until you tell me what I want. Why would he do that? He becomes this nonsensical force, which is just designed to create an exciting third act. And as they had shown in the previous movie, you don't need it. Okay, so by this point in time, they get in the ship, he defeats Krug, he pushes them into the lava, he beams on board, takes care of John Larroquette, and they escape. And the movie's sort of over, but there's still like another 15 minutes where they go to Vulcan and they have this long drawn out sequence. Oh, but before that, I want to play this one little thing. This is nice. This is probably the closest we're ever going to hear Spock and McCoy and their relationship. They're in the Klingon sick bay.
Spock. For God's sakes, talk to me. You stuck this damn thing in my head, remember? Remember? Now tell me what to do with it. Help me. Tell you something that I never thought I'd ever hear myself say. But it seems I've missed you. And I don't know if I could stand to lose you again.
What a good scene. I wish we'd seen that earlier. I wish we could have McCoy talking to Kirk about this. DeForest Kelly is such a good actor. And he just, again, this is a scene that Shatner wanted to be in, and Nimoy was like, no, you can't be in this scene. You have no reason to be sitting there as McCoy is talking to Spock. This is one of the more powerful relationships of the show. It's one of those hidden relationships. And this is one of the strongest scenes between the two of them, outside maybe the Tholian web or maybe Star Trek Beyond. Both of those had really strong Spock-McCoy scenes. Now, it's DeForest Kelly was driven kind of insane by Leonard Nimoy in this scene because Nimoy couldn't direct Kelly. He couldn't see. They didn't have playback back then. He just had to trust that Kelly was doing what he wanted him to do. And so DeForest Kelly was convinced that Nimoy was trying to direct him with his eyelids, that like he was like briefly flickering his eye. I don't know what, but it's such a funny vision to think that, you know, he's like, stop blinking your eyelids. I can see that you're trying to direct me. In classic McCoy Spock fashion. Again, it would have been nicer to have this dynamic a little stronger. I get what they're going for. They're trying to right the ship. They're trying to figure out, okay, if we put all our eggs into the Kirk basket, what's that going to yield? And it yielded stronger results than Star Trek One. But you need to have a little more balance with McCoy because he kind of, even though he was part of this movie, he kind of faded away to all these other pieces that we don't care about. The Klingons and Savick and David. McCoy, Spock, Scotty, Sulu, Uhura. Why did Uhura have to go away? Let's bring her back. She does show up, of course, on planet Vulcan. They do go up to Mons Sala. And Leonard H., son of David, goes through the Vulcan ritual with all these sexy Vulcan dancing women there. They don't dance, but it looks like they're going to do like a 1940s dance number there. And so finally, finally, at the end of all this, we do get Spock's return. And this exchange, finally, after the long overnight thing, overnight procedure, he returns. McCoy's like, I'm okay, Jim. He just kind of wanders away. No one seems to care about him. And then Spock comes down in these white, you know, bathrobes. He turns. He looks at Kirk.
My father says that you have been my friend. You came back for me.
You would have done the same for me.
Why would you do this?
Because the needs of the one outweighed the needs of the many.
He walks away. He turns around.
I have been and ever shall be your friend.
Yes. Yes, Spock.
The ship. Out of danger.
You saved the ship. You saved us all.
Don't you remember?
Spock tries. But then he looks. He gets closer.
Jim. Your name is Jim.
Yes.
McCoy points to his head as Spock looks at him. And then everyone greets him and inaudibly says hello to him. Spock turns and raises his eyebrow. Now, this sequence, when I was a kid, I didn't quite understand it. It's like, is he okay? Is he not? It seemed like is he suffering brain damage? I don't quite get it. It's like he barely remembers who these people are. Now, as it would turn out, this sort of lack of memory and lack of cohesion of his relationship, since the adventure continues. Which is apropos. Let me finish my thought here on that. At the time, it sort of bothered me and upset me that we spent this whole movie looking for Spock and we only get like half a Spock or a third of a Spock. But as the end of the movie says, and the end of the title sequence is not the adventure, the human adventure is just beginning, it says, ... the adventure continues, ... And in a way, this movie is sort of a bridge between the second and the fourth movie. We lose Spock, and it's not until the fourth movie we really get him back. This is really just the search for him. And so the expectations, the stakes are actually a little lower in some ways because it's just kind of like this ferry mission to go get him and bring him to Vulcan and get him ready to be really, really funny in Star Trek IV. The way they were able to pivot this lack of knowledge into comedy, into him sort of being this stranger in a strange land, even in his own body, with his old friends, turned out to be a brilliant maneuver. At the end of the movie, they say the need of the one outweigh the need of the many. It's a nice turn of phrase, like a flip, on the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few in the second movie, which is a beautiful sentiment. But in fact, they're wrong about this. Well, they're right about this in the movie. But Star Trek III is the reverse. It is the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. For people like Nicholas Meyer, they wanted to end the film in Star Trek II. But the needs of the many demanded that we have Spock, that we search for Spock, that we find Spock, that we get the Spock we wanted. I just knocked over a water bottle. And so the needs of the many outweighed the needs of the few or the one, and we got our Spock. And I got my podcast. And you heard about Disney. And I'm Mike McCafferty. And I just want to talk about Star Trek.